it's there. Like love and optimism are superpowers. Like, and not just like, you know, manifest and just thinking things will go well. But if you like truly like put that frequency out there and you're like, and you can get to a point of true presence, it can change the trajectory of things. You know, I'm only here because people sent me love and like I could feel it when I was trying to fight to come back.
Oh, I'm excited for this one. And I'm sure you've heard of Amaze. Seen the ads on Instagram or Facebook, gazed at those huge homes that they give away and thought, surely this is too good to be true. Well, it isn't, because I interviewed Amaze's co-founder, Matt Paulson, and he's here to spill the beans. He believes that the old models are broken, that have us making a choice, I suppose, between a company that's impactful and maybe charitable and only doing good, and a company that's just good for business, just about the bottom line, is a corporate, so to speak. And he so eloquently tells the story of merging these two worlds. And it's why the tagline, it's win-win, is exactly right. And Matt's here to tell us why that's the case. And as you know, I believe in this. I believe that businesses have the power to change the world, can be more impactful than government. Matt's journey has taken him from an early career in American politics, a little bit of acting, to a near-death experience that has changed his perspective. And he really opens up his soul in this interview and tells us about these worlds merging and what good can be done and this unbelievable vision. I end the podcast by, not that you'll hear this, telling him I'm going to be able to say that one day I interviewed Matt Paulson, because I'm reckoning we've got the next Branson or something here. I'm just telling you, heard it here first. He's a guiding star for those who want to make impact, run businesses, and be a founder for good. Enjoy.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. So let's begin this week's conversation of inspiration. Matt, such a pleasure to meet you. I just told my husband who I was interviewing, and he actually said, could you let him know who I am? As if that meant he was going to win something. So if you could just take his name down and...
I'll just send him the keys to a house.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. Matt, great. Welcome to Conversations of Inspiration.
Thanks for having me. I'm inspired to be here.
In a nutshell, I wanted to talk about your business, obviously, throughout all of this, and you as a human being. But for anyone who doesn't know Amaze, it is a company that gives everyone a chance to win a once-in-a-lifetime prize, all whilst helping make the world a better place. The number in terms of the millions that you have given to charity since you launched in 2020 is unbelievable. Tell me about that number and how it works. So for those who don't understand it, but I just couldn't believe 2020 and you have pumped how much into UK charities?
60 million pounds.
Yeah. Am I right in saying, I just needed to just jump in before you tell everyone how it works. That is such a huge amount of money. I'm trying to think of other companies that can say they've in 4 years pumped 60 million pounds into charity.
Not a long list. I think it puts us right at the top of corporate donors. You know, our vision is within the next 3 years to be the number one source of charitable funds in the UK, outside the UK government.
Now, everyone's going, how the hell is he doing this? So to tell everyone, Amaze, for those who don't know it, how it works.
Yeah, so we offer the chance, as you said, to win dream houses and other prizes that also benefits charity. So we're an entertainment company with a social purpose. You know, we're not a fundraising company. We're for profit, but 17% of our gross sales go to a charity. Each month there's a new house with a new charity partner associated with it. So for example, in July, we did a house on Victoria Park. It's a beautiful 5 million pound modern house there. And that benefited the London Air Ambulance. The London Air Ambulance was trying to raise enough money to fund the new helicopters. The London Air Ambulance is those red helicopter ambulances you see. And so they needed to raise another 3 million pounds in order to be able to fund the new helicopters because they were mandated to retire the old ones. And so we came in and helped raise them, and we raised 4 million pounds for them in that month.
Extraordinary. Extraordinary. Oh, God, I'm so excited. Okay, so that's the mechanism. And like I've just done this morning, I went onto the site and I bought my tickets to win, basically.
Thank you.
And that's literally as simple as it is. This amazing house that I've got a chance now of winning. And then every month, am I right in saying, you do a draw and someone wins that. But at the same time, this charity is going to get a huge donation. And every month it changes a charity.
Yeah. Each month, new charity, each month, new house. And, you know, we've gotten to the point where, so a lot of our customers are subscribers. They enter into every single house. And so because, you know, it's such a great community and the Omaze community is so continually supportive, you know, we're now raising each month these kind of numbers for different charity partners. Last month for the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, which was doing this huge rewilding project, we raised 4.9 million pounds.
It's incredible. I want to get into the whole idea about corporates and those who are building companies that are profitable also doing good. And I think this is just a really interesting area. For myself, I'm highly interested for Holly & Co., but also for those listening. I know the type of audience that we have, and this sort of different way of looking at business is what we're really interested about. But I'm going to start, though, going back to Orange County, California. I'm going to start with the fact that you were the eldest of three children. And I read when researching you that your mother, Terry, worked in a hospital supporting end-of-life patients, and your father, Gary, was a defense attorney, although he had trained to be a priest before he met your mum. is this right? Tell me, these are people that have got amazing jobs. What was that like growing up surrounded by them?
Yeah, I mean, my dad was in the seminary to be a priest, and one weekend, him and his best friend, Rick, decided they were going to sneak out. It was like a very almost monastic seminary, so you weren't allowed to leave. And so they snuck out and they hitchhiked down Coast Highway, PCH, the famous PCH in California, down to Rick's house, which was in an area called Corona del Mar, like Newport Beach area. And they went into the house and Rick's 19-year-old sister was sitting there with curlers on, and that's my mom.
So they just decided that they weren't going to do the whole God route.
Yeah, it took him a little while, but I think, you know, I think he saw some God in my mom. They've been together 52 years now. They're an amazing, I mean, I've learned so much from them. I couldn't be more grateful to have those two parents. And I think to your question, my dad worked with people who, you know, had gotten in difficult situations and in many cases had done terrible crimes, but he had an ability to always see the best in people, no matter what they had done. Mm. You know, and a lot of people, most of his clients were people that were born into tough situations and were trying to make ends meet and had to take some measures that are obviously not ideal, but they're still like good people. There's others that did much worse things, but like, you know, my uncle had gone sideways in his life. My dad's youngest brother and ended up on the street and, you know, died basically between jail and the streets. And we knew he was a good person, but like, you know, they had a tough upbringing. And so, I think he had the ability to see his brother and all those other people. He taught me, if you see the best in people, then they will show you the best of them. And yeah, my mom worked in a blood bank, and then she did this program called No One Dies Alone, where she would sit with people at the end of their life who didn't have anyone else.
So that must have been such an interesting mix. You know, I always talk about the breakfast table on this podcast of when our entrepreneurs are growing up and literally what we're absorbing as we're eating our cereal, we're also absorbing the sort of the air that we're living in. And that's the golden thread that I potentially see in you now. It's an amazing thing to look at. Did you enjoy school? Because I know you went on to study economics and political science at Stanford. So I'm assuming by that, by the way, that you were quite academic.
I did. I love school. Yes, I would say I did well in school. I found it engaging. I was always really curious. I liked taking tests. It was kind of psychotically competitive, I guess. I loved it.
Lucky you. Good. So many people come on this podcast going, school was the worst time of my life and I was not set up for it. And then it's so interesting to see that, because in when you carried on, though, from school, I read that you also had a fitness side to you. You were sporty, that you played basketball for Compton. So not only were you enjoying school with your academic side, and this was a deprived area of LA, and the friends that you met on the team had fewer opportunities than your friends at home. Again, that DNA when you were eating your cereal, was that starting to come through? Were you understanding from your parents actually what you were then also surrounded by on the basketball pitch?
So I was pretty good at basketball when I was a kid. And when I was 10 years old, I got invited to play on this team that won the national championships, which was a big deal. It's called the AAU National Championships. And it's basically like the World Cup for youth basketball. We had a bunch of players on that team who ended up playing in the NBA, you know, real stars, names that people would know. And I lived in Laguna Beach, which is a nice suburb in Orange County. We were upper middle class. Like, a lot of my friends were upper class. And so I'd seen that life. And then when I went to Compton, you know, I was one of the only white guys on the team. I like was in an area that was really underserved. I saw the disadvantages that my close friends had that I spent, you know, a lot of my childhood with. And so that made me like really clear of like, oh, wow, this is like, these are pretty different opportunities, you know. Mm-hmm. And some of my friends from Laguna don't even really realize what they have or what kind of advantages we have. And so I think that was part of like what came into wanting to, you know, help fight inequality in one way, shape or form.
And I read that you said you were made aware pretty young that the game isn't fair. And so we all have to give back to try and make it fair. And, you know, again, this is all stepping stones to the story that we're going to tell today with your business. As I mentioned earlier, you went off to Stanford and you were studying economics and political science. And during that time, you were actually an intern for Vice President Al Gore, but you realized that politics wasn't for you and that you had quite a famous person in your class.
Chelsea Clinton?
Yeah.
Yes, I was there under Al Gore. He's an amazing guy, so charismatic. Actually, I think he had a trouble translating that when he ran the way that he would in a room. And he was doing this program called the E-Rate program, which was bringing the internet to underserved rural communities in the U.S. And I worked on that. But yeah, I just kind of looked at that world and thought, if I go here, I might not end up a very good person. Like, not because they were bad people, but just because I know my personality, I'm competitive and, you know, at that point, probably to a fault. And I just thought like the incentive structure and what you know, I think everybody starts facing forward, you know, and wanting to do good, but then you just make these small little compromises and each one's just a little bit more than the rest. But then over time, you all of a sudden you're facing totally to the right, you know, you've kind of gone in a different direction. And I thought that might happen to me. So, and I actually remember talking to Chelsea about that. And it was while President Clinton was being impeached for the Monica Lewinsky scandal. So it was a really bizarre thing to be talking with Chelsea about like Washington, D.C. and the politics and what that world does to you while her dad was going through that thing. And it made me just realize like, it's probably not the world for me.
It's quite depressing, isn't it? I mean, I'm going to get back to your story with we look at what's going on in politics today in the UK. We look at politics in general. And how you think about our young, and you think, will they ever want to join?
Yeah.
You know, that's you many years ago feeling that way. And I don't think things have much improved. You know, my son, he always had such an opinion. My mother always said that my son would, you know, you must get into politics. You must get into politics. He's now 20. He couldn't think of anything worse than getting into politics. And he's a prime, you know, he's an educated guy. All these things, he's got real vision and he's got passion about so many things. And he could get into that world. He couldn't think of anything worse. Do you think that this is just going to become a dying, or people like yourself with the heart that you had, but you had the foresight to know that you were going to drift away from what you believe in? Do you think that that's always going to be the case?
It's tough. I mean, you can make a lot of arguments why it would, which is that it's become more polarized. It's become more about fundraising than actual work. It's a lot more theatrical than it ever was. Social media is not helpful, I would say, for this world. So that's, you know, that is, you can make a case in almost any country. Like, you know, I think all these people who get into it are, I do want to do good, but then it's just like, it's a tough life. Mm-hmm. What does give me hope is that I'm not as familiar with like kind of the up and comers here in the UK, but in the US, there's actually like a rising generation in their 30s and early 40s that is pretty inspiring, really sharp, like gone to all the best schools, diverse group. And so, you know, there's about to be a big choice in the US. We'll see what happens. Yeah. That will send us in two very different directions. But, you know, assuming that it's democracy is still how we operate in the future, then I think there's some really impressive people coming. But it is hard. And there's so many other ways to make an impact that it's a tougher choice to make.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about that. That's, you know, I always try when I mentor small businesses and things, and just to say, you know, you are, you know, as a collective, you know, people can be more powerful than government. You know, you just talked about earlier what you want to do in terms of your charitable donations. It's incredible when you think about it, but I really want people to hold on to that our businesses can absolutely be huge forces for good. And actually, if you're disillusioned by politics, then build a business that's going to change the world. But you decide, right, I'm looking forward, I'm going to be doing something I don't want to do, so I'm going to become an actor.
Yeah.
And you were on Scrubs. That's pretty cool. the acting life was what you wanted to do?
Yeah, that kind of came out of nowhere. I remember telling my parents that, you know, I think with my Stanford degree that they just, you know, paid a lot of money for, that I'm going to become an actor. That was definitely surprising to them. It was surprising to me. It just looked really fun. I did a play in college just for fun, and it was so fun. And you learn to see the world through the eyes of another person. And I really believe in the power of storytelling. Like, I think storytelling is the most underrated skill in business. I didn't really know that at the time, but I thought, well, you know what? Like, I'm going to have a lot of fun with this. Whatever happens, I think I'm going to learn a lot. I'm going to fail a lot. Like, I'd been mostly successful at that point in my life. I'm like, I'm going to fail. I didn't realize I would fail as much as I did at it, but I knew it was going to be hard. You know, and I'm saying these things in hindsight, I'm probably giving myself too much credit for my wisdom at the time, but I felt like it would be a fun adventure. And whatever happened, it would be a good adventure.
And was it?
It was. It was hard. I did fail a lot. I got to do some great stuff, but ultimately I realized that wasn't my calling.
No.
That I wasn't meant to be an actor. But I think so much of what has made us successful at Omaze is a result of that experience. Really understanding storytelling. You know, then ultimately I became a filmmaker, which was a much more natural fit, like producing and writing and directing. But the skills that I learned there, and also just the empathy, like how do you see the world through someone else's eyes, has helped me, I think, hopefully be a better leader, a better partner, a better coach to my team. And even also help, like, create a better product for our community to know, like, you know, what they would want.
Well, it was at a time that you were in LA, you just mentioned, and with your co-founder, Ryan Cummins, and you were working in the entertainment industry, as you said, filmmakers, taking part in huge events such as Live Earth to raise awareness for climate change. So what was the journey that took you from the work that you were doing at that time to the idea of disrupting the charity sector? And you mentioned storytelling, and I think it's just so obvious that that is coming through in everything, looking at your site, looking at the way you're telling these stories. But specifically, what inspired that action?
Yeah, so we started writing mostly initially to get jobs as an actor, and then started realizing I really liked it. Then I really got excited about this idea of using storytelling to inspire action, and so did Live Earth, as you mentioned, did this documentary called Girl Rising about girls' education in the developing world that was funded by Oprah and Queen Rania of Jordan. We worked with all these amazing, influential people, Bono, Jay-Z, Bill Gates, you know, and then just realized that we were creating a lot of awareness around these projects, but we weren't creating a lot of impact. You know, these people authentically wanted to do good. We weren't doing that much good. So I went to business school and tried to learn new ways of thinking. I had never even opened Excel before I got to Wharton. I was purely on the creative side. And then when I was in school, me and Ryan went to this event that Magic Johnson, the basketball player, was hosting, where he was auctioning off the chance to play basketball with him and go to a Lakers game. But it was only available to the high net worth individuals in the room. Mm-hmm. And we were in the room, but not high net worth individuals. You were like the guys who get invited last minute to fill the table and come for the free drinks. And so we sat there and watched as the auction went up to 15,000. And Magic was my childhood hero. Like, there's nothing that I would rather do than play basketball with Magic Johnson. And so when we were driving home that night, we said, you know, that doesn't make any sense. Like, Magic has fans around the world, not just in that room. And the people who can't afford to be in that room care a lot more about meeting him than those who can. And at that time, celebrities weren't really on social media, but we said, you know, they're going to be. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be able to reach their fans in a whole new way. So if we make it so anybody donates $10 for the chance to win, we could raise so much more money, so much more awareness, open up a whole new donor base.
And that was on the drive home.
That was on the drive home. Yeah.
Since I was a child, I've always been curious about art, passionate about trying new things, and fascinated by finding new ways to express myself. And since setting up my first business, Not on the High Street, my vision has always been to create a world in which someone just like you or I can be creatively inspired. Whether that be through a podcast like this one, by helping you turn your dreams into a business, or to enjoy shopping for thoughtful, never seen before finds that take you in a new direction or help you show the world how you feel. When I discovered the small business community, it felt like I'd come home. Here are people who can translate emotions into objects, people who can conceive of things we never could and have talent beyond our wildest imaginations. That's why I set up Holly & Co, to bring them all together as a collective, to support each other and to help you become the person you've always wanted to be. I've handpicked them all, so we have skills in all areas, from embroiderers and bakers to glass etchers and paper bird makers, and so that you too can learn the rich stories behind each one. For me, it's a dream come true, and I hope it inspires you too. Visit holly.co to find out more. Now, back to our conversation of inspiration. It fascinates me that the purpose that, you know, is at the total center and the heart of an entrepreneur. And it's turning something on its head and seeing the possibilities where others don't. And I'm sure you know her, and if not, definitely you'll really like her, Zoe Calara, who formerly is known as Sue Finesse, who started We Are Eight and interviewed her. And she too saw social media and said, hang on a second, this is not right. We're going to do something different. And she's now built We Are Eight in basically to help bring power back to people on the planet and go up against Zuckerberg and go up against what we're experiencing with social media now and making it basically a home that we feel comfortable within. And it's this amazing power that the fact that you just were sitting in a car thinking, right, well, that's what we could do. And Zoe thought exactly the same thing. And then you've gone and done it. And this is the thing for everyone listening. That's it. They were just sitting in a car thinking about the idea and they go and do it. And at that start of Amaze, you had $200,000 worth of debt. You'd been offered and turned down another job, but you just knew in your heart that this is what you know, it factually didn't make sense at this point in time, but you still went for it. How did your fear manifest itself and how did you manage it? Like, did you ever think it was not going to be possible? Because it's scary starting.
Yeah, it's a great question. I was really scared. There were other things in my life that I'd done. Like when I became an actor, I wasn't really scared. You know, I was like 21 years old and I was like, I didn't feel like there was anything to lose. When I decided to go for Omaze, I was absolutely scared. I had a job offer. I had $200,000 in debt. I had a job offer from McKinsey, but I just felt in my soul I couldn't do it. And so I had turned that down. And they said, well, what are you going to do? And this is before I'd come up with the idea for Omaze. It was actually the night before I came up with the idea for Omaze. I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. And they're like, we've never heard that before. It's like, I'm not proud of it. I'm just like, I just can't do this. But I do think that burning the bridge behind me there actually is what inspired the idea or helped create the conditions. You know, I think, how do you get past the fear? I think what you realize is that fear is just a story, right? And the story we create, the fear of the thing is always worse than the thing itself. So my story was, I would go do this. I will have missed McKinsey. I will spend a year or 2 years. I'll even be further in debt. It'll be harder for me to get one of those jobs. And no one will ever love me and I'll die alone. You know, like that's like what the fear could tell you. But there was something deeper inside me. There was like this echo from the future. There was this like sense of knowing that this is something that should exist in the world. This is something that could be a light in the world. And I think this thing, even from the beginning, I always felt it was so much bigger than me. Like I was just like, you know, some work is by you and the great work is through you. And I just felt like this is just through me. And I happen to be the one that this is going to channel through and I have to honor that. And so that's how I got over the fear. I just like, I felt really connected to that.
That passion and that purpose, it is why, you know, it's what is the life raft, I think, for us entrepreneurs that, as you said, I love what you just said about it's channeling through you. You're of, and I feel like, and maybe I'm wrong in saying, you're of service to this idea, to the world, to the people it's going to help. It just happens to be you. You know, and I really resonate with that. It's how I feel every single day. I'm a vessel. I'm just a vessel that is channeling change potentially. And actually, how can you turn your back? Someone very annoyingly said, you can't unknow what you know. And it's very annoying at times because you knew what was going to potentially happen. And maybe you wish you could have turned that off because actually you had a great offer from McKinsey's. That 200K debt was not great. Your parents would definitely probably want you to go and take that job at that point in time. And so it's that moment where you're like, right, I'm going through it. There's a calling. I actually feel business is spiritual. I really do. Maybe your father would agree, but I do feel it can be spiritual if you are of service, if your business is trying to change the world. So you decided to start raffling experiences with celebrities, driving a tank with Arnie or a dinner date with Idris. And I'm a big Arnie fan. your biggest break, you clinched a deal with Bryan Cranston at the height of Breaking Bad, where winners could cook and travel with him in the RV used in the show. I mean, what a prize. And I think that is what having this real purpose looks like. It can make you bold to go and get those things. I mean, how the hell did you even do that? And then the ripple effect, it almost by having that sort of I've got to go and do this, you actually go and do it. So what were those early day experiences like, and those celebrities, and trying to explain to them what you wanted? Because I'm assuming you didn't just have these people on dial-up on your phone.
I think you described it really well. There was this, it's almost the greatest fuel for persistence, is feeling like you're serving others. You know, I think there's this thing that just kind of was helping drive us. You know, we didn't, you know, our first, we didn't have those people on dial. Our first experience was to be a guest judge on Cupcake Wars, and it raised $784. You know, so it was very unsuccessful beginning. Mm-hmm. With Brian, we were basically almost, we hadn't proven, we'd gone, been going for a year, we hadn't proven the model, and we had something set up with Brian and with Breaking Bad, and we thought that was going to be our big opportunity. And then this other company had come in after us, but doing a similar thing, came and launched this campaign, and they raised Samuel L. Jackson, and they raised $130,000, and the most we had raised at that point was $18,000. So that felt like they'd raised $1 billion, you know. And and then we got a call from the woman who helped like run Brian's philanthropy, saying, "Hey guys, sorry, but like Brian can no longer work with you. He's going to go work with this other company. You know, they just raised; they're raising so much more money, you know." And I was friends with her, and I said, "No, no, no, please! Like he, we can't do that. Like this is like we have to do this with him. Like we've worked so hard on it." And she's like, "Sorry, you know." And I was like, "You got to let me talk to him. Like, what's he doing this weekend? Where is he tonight? Like, what? Like, you know?" And she's like, "He's going to a charity event." And I was like, "Well, where's the charity event?" And I found out where the charity event was, and me and Ryan went, we snuck in, we like put on black ties and snuck into the charity event. And we walked up to Brian and said, you know, "Hey Brian, we talked on the phone, but you don't know who were the Maze guys. You know, we heard you're going to go work with this other company." And he said, "It's nothing personal guys. It's just that, you know, they said that they can raise 200,000. And I said, "Well, we can raise 250,000. He said, "What's the most you've ever raised?" And I said, 18,000. He said, "Well, how are you going to do that?" And I was like, "Look, Brian, you remember when you were at the beginning of your career and things weren't going how you wanted, but you knew inside that you had this within you and like that you would do anything you could to make an opportunity happen." And I was like, "That's where we are. And we will go so far and above and beyond. We will create content you that it like will spread. We will be super creative with Winnebago. We'll have the blue smoke come out of the ceiling. We'll do all the things. Like, we will do whatever it takes." And I think mostly like out of annoyance more than like inspiration, he was like, "All right, fine, I'll do it with you guys." And so then that one ended up raising 300,000. And then he introduced us to Aaron Paul, who was, for people who know the show Breaking Bad, who was Jesse on Breaking Bad. And we did the absolute finale of Breaking Bad with him, and that raised 1.7 million. And that kind of like set us off.
That set you off. Do you think, just taking a pause in the story, you snuck in, you found out where he was, you snuck in, you found him, and you told him the truth. You bared your soul with him. You basically told him you were vulnerable. So, because you could have gone in there and lied about the $18,000, couldn't you? You could have bullshitted him, but you didn't. You, on an empathy level, you connected with him. Would that be something that you advise people to do? Because I think when you're starting out, you know, whether it's called imposter syndrome, all of those sorts of things, do you think that there is a strength in vulnerability?
I do. It's really hard, but people just want to trust. I think at the end of the day, we all just want to feel connected. We want to feel like a sense of deep connection. And you can only feel a deep connection if you feel a sense of trust. And you only feel trust if you feel like someone's actually being authentic with you. Mm-hmm. And so think of, you're trying to build something with purpose and you're trying to build something that's sustainable. That kind of vulnerability is really important. And it's hard. I'm vulnerable with my team sometimes when I don't know things. That's still hard for me. You know, there's still part of me that says, "Why don't you know those things?" But I think that's the world that we live in now, in a beautiful way. You know, I think like leadership used to be like this kind of like General Patton, like World War II, like go take that hill and I have absolute confidence that that's going to work. That's just not the world. The world's complicated and messy, and I don't think that works anymore. Being vulnerable and honest is just like a much better way to go through life. You end up paying the price for those lies at some point, or those like acting at some point, you know?
Yeah. And I think business is, it's certainly, you know, if you get the right people listening, ask enough people and they're going to take a chance on you. Someone beautifully said on this podcast, you know, business, basically in your business journey, you'll find angels. And there's just angels just planted along the way in your business journey that you'll just come across. And in a way, Brian was that angel just then. He just said yes. Right. And that was just the pivot. That was the sliding doors moment. That was the thing. And just, you know, we should believe in angels. I certainly have them in my life. I've been blessed with one. And this week I just wrote a card and said, without you, without that moment, I wouldn't be here today. For talking about not being here today, I wasn't literally going to have sudden heart failure like yourself, but the company's on its way. And then out of the blue, something just happened that was totally life-changing for you. You suffered a bowel obstruction that triggered sudden heart failure, and you died on the operating table and flatlined for 4.5 minutes before being brought back to life. I was wondering if you could just share that personal story with us. It's quite shocking.
Yeah, it's funny. Even when I hear someone say it about me, it almost feels like
out of body. You
know, another
person.
Yeah, it's one of those things you never expect is going to be part of your life story. But yeah, it is part of mine. The way it happened was when I was born, my stomach was twisted in a knot. I was supposed to die when I was born, and then they did this, you know, big surgery to fix that. There was 2/3 of my small intestine. And then 40 years later, scar tissue from that surgery somehow freakishly kind of like broke off and helped create this bowel obstruction. And I didn't know that at the moment. I just knew that my stomach was really hurting. My stomach has hurt my whole life because of that surgery. So it was kind of normal for me. But then it kind of get to the point where it looked like I was like 9 months pregnant. So I called my friend who's a doctor and said, hey, this is what's going on. I'm throwing a party tonight. I'd like to be at that party, but I just want to make sure I don't need to go to the hospital. He said, you should go to the hospital. It might be that your appendix is bursting. Maybe you'll be back in time. So I go there. They do all these tests. They can't figure out what's going on. My parents are there. Our COO, Helen, are there at the hospital because I was supposed to be meeting her. And then after hours of this, they just say to them, okay, you know, we're going to keep Matt overnight. You guys go home. If he's not better in the morning, if this doesn't just work itself out, then we'll do surgery then. You know, no big deal. So they leave. Helen pulls into her driveway. At this point, it's 11 o'clock at night. She's been in the hospital all day. She's exhausted and she's going to get out of her car. And something tells her that she should go back to the hospital. And Helen is British. A COO, she's very serious. She's not like a Venice Beach, listen to the cosmos person. You know, this is like totally out of character for her. But she said the voice was undeniable. So she drove back. And if she hadn't driven back, I probably would have died like 45 minutes later because my blood pressure had plummeted and the machine's not alerted the nurse. And she came in and she had been in the hospital.
It hadn't alerted the nurse.
No. You still don't know why, but yeah, she came in and had been in the hospital with her grandmother back here in Devon for a couple of weeks. And so she knew how to read like the blood pressure and she knew that that was very low. So she went and got the doctor and the doctor saw it and immediately called in a crash team. They rushed me down into surgery. I came out of surgery and then they said to my mom, the good news is we figured out what it is. It's a bowel obstruction. The bad news, he's in critical condition. His heart rate's continuing to plummet and we don't know why. A couple hours pass. My mom goes downstairs to get my dad and my brother. She's coming back up and she hears over the loudspeaker code blue in room 437. And my mom worked in the hospital. So she knew that meant flatline and she knew that was my room. So she got off the elevator. She ran down the hall. And she got to the door and the nurse said, I'm sorry, you can't come in. This is very serious. And my mom said, look, I was there when he came in this world. If he's leaving this world right now, I'm going to be in that room. So she lets her in the room and I'm flatlined. And they're doing the defibrillator, you know, the paddles. and my body is bouncing up and down, but I'm not responding, totally flatlined. So my mom, you know, starts to lose it a little bit, starts to crumble, because, you know, it's one thing to lose a child. It's another thing if it's right there in front of you. And at the same time, my dad was outside with my brother, and this doctor came out and said to another doctor in front of my brother, not knowing it's my brother, "Hey, I think we lost this guy. I think he's gone." And so my brother pushed my dad in the room, and my dad kind of, you know, if you're the listeners, kind of my mom was faced kind of the right. My dad came in from the left, and he was crying so loudly because he thought it was already gone. But my mom turned to him to say, like, "Gary, you gotta be quiet, or they're gonna kick us out of this room." And when she did that, she said she saw something she'd never seen before in a hospital. She said that every nurse and every staff member and every doctor in the ICU had just gravitated outside this window. And there was like 40 of them. And she said they looked like this silent church choir, just sending in positive energy. And she was so moved that these people were sending love to her son that they didn't even know, that it was like this spiritual experience for her. It just filled her up with strength. And she started coaching me. You know, she was like, "Matthew David Poulsen, these people are fighting to save your life. They are fighting so hard to bring you back, but you're not fighting hard enough. You need to show them you're a fighter, Matthew David Poulsen. You need a fight to come back to us." You know, they said it was a surreal experience because here's this 65-year-old mom in the operating room. There's never a 65-year-old mom in the operating room on Grey's Anatomy. Like, they're not allowed in there, you know, but yeah, she was in there. And as you said, the flatline went on for 4.5 minutes, which is a long time. They don't always fight that long. But because she kept fighting, they kept fighting. But then at one point, you know, my mom started to think like, "Oh my God, I'm going to lose my son. You know, and if I lose my son, my husband's probably going to die of a broken heart." Mm-hmm. And so she was trying to process that. She was there. And then at the same time, the main doctor kind of shook his head as if to say, like, this is done. And he turned away. And she grabbed his arm. She said, please don't call it yet. And then he turned back and he said, "Wait a second." And then they're looking at the flatline machine and, you know, just watching it go along and going along and waiting to see if there's just some kind of sign of it like ticking up. But instead of that, then they said something happened that they'd truly never seen before in the hospital. Instead of the thing taking up, all of a sudden, I popped up.
Oh my God.
And then the whole room kind of like looked at me. And I remember opening up and seeing this room of people just like with their mouths wide open, like in shock. And then I looked over and I saw my mom and then I saw my dad. And I kind of lifted my right arm and gave him a thumbs up.
I normally cry at the end. What a loss of words. What a moment. I mean, that story, I mean, how you sit up and you give the thumbs up, you then obviously go into recovery. What do you think that meant? How did it change your perspective of life?
It's a funny thing. Like, those things happen and people expect you to have like enlightenment. Mm-hmm. You know, they expect all of a sudden you're like the next day, you just know these things that you didn't know before. And that was not how it worked. But over time, like two of the bigger lessons that have set in for me are, one, be a best friend to yourself. Mm. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but you can't really love others if you don't love yourself. And I didn't realize it because I would say things to myself that I would not say to other people. Like, I'm a good friend. And someone asked me once, like, you know, "Do you ever hold grudges?" I say, "No, I don't hold grudges. I always forgive people." They said, "But what about against yourself?" Oh my God, I haven't forgiven myself for things I did 5 years ago, you know? And so, once you do that, then you can spread love to others. And that's the second like big lesson I would say, is just like, love and optimism are superpowers. Mm. Like, there are things that I believe about the world now that I did not believe before this happened to me. You know, I had an experience on the other side of like not seeing the light per the traditional way it's been described, but like feeling a sense of total oneness, total love. And I see that around me now in ways that I didn't see before. I believe that like love and optimism, like are frequencies that can change the course of events, and that we can feel it. And the physics proves that now, like that's not just like my, I believe consciousness exists outside the brain because like, how did I make it? How did I make it? And if I would have heard this story from somebody else before this happened, I would have thought, oh, they dreamed that or they, whatever, you know, like that's not really, but it's there. Like love and optimism are superpowers. Like, and not just like, you know, manifest and just thinking things will go well. But if you like truly like put that frequency out there and you like, and you can get to a point of true presence, it can change the trajectory of things. You know, I'm only here because people sent me love and like I could feel it when I was trying to fight to come back.
Unbelievable.
Dell Technologies are passionate champions of small businesses. They recognize that it can be a lonely road, and so they have the Dell Women's Entrepreneur Network, or DWEN for short, which is a worldwide community of over 100,000 female founders. They run free events and mentoring programs and have a network of brilliant women all connecting and sharing insight. They also recognize that for many small businesses, visibility is one of the biggest challenges they face when trying to reach new customers. So each week, Dell give away their ad break space. So now I'm going to hand over to this week's winner of Dell's independent ad break.
Hi, my name is Jenny and I'm the founder of Combat Fitness with Jenny. Combat Fitness with Jenny is a combination of combat sports and fitness. So not only will you get fighting fit, but you'll learn brand new skills as well, such as boxing, kickboxing and Krav Maga. This year, 2024, we have also started a new side to Combat Fitness with Jenny, which is Queens of Self-Protection, which is ladies' self-defense training. It's a total different aspect of training to any of my Combat Fitness with Jenny. My business means the world to me as I get to meet some amazing people along this journey. I never thought I would get to work with such amazing people. Everybody that attends absolutely loves their training sessions. They progress, they achieve, and not only that, they then pass it on to somebody else. We've got a brilliant community. Everybody is so helpful and supportive. So we have two aspects. We have the Combat Fitness with Jenny and also Queens of Self-Protection for Lady Self-Defense.
Thank you, Dell, for your support and generosity. If you'd like to find out more about DWEN and connect with brilliant and inspiring women, or you'd like to be in with a chance to have your very own ad break here on this series, head to holly.co/Dell. Now, back to this week's conversation of inspiration.
I can't tell you how much I agree with, never heard it so eloquently put, that love and optimism is a frequency. And actually, those of us who are trying to be of service, I think we'll take that away and we'll really hold that in our hearts now, because the way that we can exist in the world and what we're experiencing and building businesses, and it's tough. It's tough. And it's not really often that you're talking to your board or whatever about love and optimism. you know, these are not the words that are coming up, but actually deep in the souls of us founders, that is our frequency. That is something that we believe in and we're holding tight and we're building our dreams based on that rhythm, based on that melody of the world. And we can feel it and see it, and other people can't necessarily. So it's an honor to hear you say that, really, because I think that's going to help so many people. I want to come back to your Amaze and the actual business. You launched in the UK in 2020. You'd pivoted your business from the sort of celebrity side into the houses. And tell me why you did that. And I've been, actually, you've had me already crying a few times, because I had teary eyes when I watched the videos on your website of people winning the homes. I mean, this is, you're like a dream maker as a job, which is not bad, is it?
Going from the US to the UK is not a not a well-worn path.
It's not, no.
So, I mean, basically what happened is after that experience, you know, I was out for many months and I came back and your perspective changed. And it became clear that we were never going to be truly world-changing. Was never going to be able to put love and optimism out at scale if we were just doing celebrity experiences, because we didn't control our own supply. And so 6 months before I'd gone to the hospital, we had done this campaign with Daniel Craig where you got to go to New York, you got to go to the Aston Martin track, you got to ride around in a one-of-a-kind Aston Martin, and you got to keep Aston Martin. And it was supposed to raise $300,000 for the United Nations, and it raised $2.1 million. So then I went to our CFO, Nina, and said, hey, I think we should take a bet. I think we should buy a $250,000 McLaren. We should offer it with just Omaze distribution, no talent, and see if we could raise $500,000 on our own, because then we would really have something. And it was a big bet because we only had $900,000 in the bank. So yeah. Spending $250,000 on a McLaren is a big, undertaking. But we did it. And then that car, campaign for that car, coincidentally launched the day before I unexpectedly went into the hospital. So when I came back all those months later and I was sitting down with Nina and I was struggling to be back and trying to find myself and like reconnect to what, you know, with the purpose with all this new experience. But I said to Nina, I said, hey, whatever happened with the McLaren, did it raise the 500,000? And she said it raised 1.9 million. And I was like, that changes everything. So then we went to the board and the team, you know, a month later and said, all right, we're going to go all in on these prizes. And we started, you know, that was a big change for us because we were the celebrity business. We did all this crazy stuff. And so we said, we started doing holidays and that worked. And then we started doing watches and Birkin bags and sneakers and that worked. And we started doing more cars and that worked. And then we started doing supercars and that really worked. And then we said, you know, where it's really at is houses. A car changes someone's lifestyle, but a house changes someone's life. And there's also this emotional connection, this like Maslow's hierarchy of needs that just kind of light up inside of us when we see a house. It's safety, it's security, it's status, it's relationships, it's self-actualization. And so we decided we were going to go into that. But we had a really good business going in the US with the celebrities and the cars. And it's such a big country. We didn't really know how to do the houses. So we said, we decided to test it here. You know, much higher density, some less expensive houses in better areas. We had a great operator here that we thought would really do a good job launching it, named James Oakes. And that's how that happened. And then it just took off so fantastically. Like the pace was such a rocket that ultimately it was like, we clearly need to be just doing this instead of the celebrities and the cars. And then ultimately, you know, made the decision like, okay, we considered doing it in both markets, but we wanted to get to the point where we could do a house a month here, and that's expensive and requires buying a lot of houses up front, taking a lot of risk. And we just decided to focus here and then eventually go back.
Amazing. And tell me, it rocketed. So on average, how many entries do you sell for each draw? And how does it work with the charity? You know, so did you know it was going to be a charity per month? I mean, or was it a slow burn to sort of get that to per month number?
Yeah, we knew it was going to be a charity per house.
Per house, right.
Each house would have its own charity. But it was, you know, our first house went for 7 months because we just didn't know how long it would take to raise enough to get close to having something meaningful to charity and for us to not lose too much on that house. We knew we would lose money on the first couple of houses. Then we got down to 3 months, then we got down to two, and then last year we got to one a month. But it's actually hard to like find 12 dream houses a year, design them in a specific style that is both true to Omaze, but also appealing to a wider audience. You know, we're now building houses in certain areas that don't have newer houses. And so it took us a while to build up to the house a month. And so now we're at the point where each month, new house, new charity partner.
Gosh. And tell me, there is skepticism. There is criticism because basically you're also very honest. You're upfront about the fact that you have to be a profitable business. This isn't a charity. So this is actually a merging of these two worlds in one. And actually that can do good. What do you say to the critics?
I think we're taught at a young age that you have to choose to either do good in your life or to make money and, you know, create mm-hmm. opportunity for your family. You don't get to do both.
Mm. Yeah.
We think that's a false choice. You know, we think that business needs to be a force for good. Mm. But you shouldn't have to make, if you have to make some massive sacrifice in order to do that, like way less people are going to do it. And so if you can create something that where both sides win, then how's that not a good thing? Like the money that we raise for our charity partners, these are all like 95% of the people have never donated to that charity before.
Yeah.
Like this is totally, you know, if you talk to them, it's totally incremental money. And also the charity sector is asked to play by these like crazy rules where they can't like pay people market rates to hire. They're not allowed to invest in marketing. They can't invest in long-term projects that take a while to pay back. So like if someone from a charity went to their board and said, let's go buy a 5 million pound house in Victoria Park and offer that, that would never happen.
No.
So, but you know, we are a for-profit company, like first and foremost, like we are an entertainment company. That's what we offer with a social purpose. We think those things are aligned, but we're out to create a really big business that can one day become the number one source of charitable funds in the world outside government. But we're proudly pursuing, you know, also a great economic opportunity for the people that work here.
You know, we think about some of the companies coming through and it's all with B Corp coming through and all of these sorts of things. You know, we have got a new perspective on business. You know, one of my missions really is, you know, I'm ultimately going to change lives within women with Holly & Co. Yeah, you can go and buy, it's a marketplace, right? So that's okay. So that's what it's known for. And I'm like talking to people saying, yes, it is a marketplace, but guess what? That's just the foundation of the company. That's what you want to call it. There's this thing that we're going to do on top of this that no other sort of brand, retail brand has ever done. You know, you're going to emotionally connect to it. I talk to women a lot of time and I say to them, with all your transactions that you do, you spend 80% of the disposable income. Tell me in any of those transactions what you emotionally connect to a company, a brand. And over the last 3 years, not one woman has ever, and I've spoken to thousands in my talks and things like that, I just stop the audience and we talk about it. Not one person has been able to tell me a brand that they transact with and they emotionally feel for.
Right.
How is that even possible? You know, and so that's the opportunity. And so when people can look at a business and you're like, yeah, but that is hopefully smart founders of the future who are creating the stability in order to do unbelievable things that used to be maybe frowned upon. Oh, they've gone to work for a charity. And actually you're reimagining this merging of these two worlds. It's a phenomenal thing. And think about, and I'm assuming, like you said, 95% of those who enter your competitions don't even know the charity. So then you're, I'm assuming, giving that charity all of those people. I mean, how many people enter your competitions? Because this must be a huge amount of brand awareness for that charity.
Yeah, we've found like huge upticks because, you know, we're spending, you know, millions of pounds on advertising that then has the charity prominently featured. And so they're getting, you know, tens of millions of impressions. We've had a lot of our partners say they've gotten huge influxes to the site and huge influxes of subscribers, all that kind of stuff. We can't share the customers we get directly with our charity partners because mm-hmm. of GDPR, yeah. but their brand awareness goes up in addition to the funds. And that's a big part of it.
You've mentioned for you and the younger Matt and the thinking about what your dreams are for this business, it feels like you're just getting started. And that's just amazing. It must be amazing to wake up each day feeling that. What are your dreams for the company?
Our long-term vision is we want to be Fortune 500 impact number one. So a revenue generating company is on the Fortune 500 list, which right now is, you know, you're doing $8 billion in revenue and the number one source of charitable funds in the world outside government. Right now, that's the Gates Foundation. The way that we do that is you know, we think we could really grow within this market. The UK is our headquarters, and will continue to be our you know, global headquarters. And so we will really grow within the UK and hopefully become a bigger and bigger source of public finance. But we intend to take this around the world. We're going to launch in Australia in February. If that goes well, we'll come back to Western Europe. And, you know, then we think there's at least 23 countries that we could do this in that works from a kind of a regulatory perspective. But we, you know, we really believe that this is universal. Mm. Whether you're from London or Sydney or Seoul, like, you want a better house on the water.
Yeah.
You know? And so, yeah, our vision is to expand globally and hopefully have the kind of impact we're having here, there. And we think it could be a real source of light. You know, these, like, there's obviously the transformation for the people who win the houses. There's a sense of transformation for the people who are beneficiaries of the charities, who get resources and opportunities that they didn't have. But there's also, you know, these stories that we get to witness, like, are so beautiful, and we want to spread those. It, you know, because, like, there's enough darkness that comes through our phones and our TVs. If you can see something that just reminds you that, like, there are opportunities to change in the world, they're like, there are people out there that are trying to make the world better for others in these charities that we work with, like, that can have a ripple effect.
This has just been just such an interesting conversation, Matt, and I've enjoyed it so, so much. I'm wondering now if I can hand over to you to talk to the younger Matt.
Yeah.
And I don't know what you're going to say, but thank you in advance for sharing a little bit of your soul with us today.
Thank you, Holly. You're a beautiful interviewer. Your spirit and your heart really creates a space where you can feel comfortable to share. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Dear younger Matthew, first, you must be wondering how this letter got to you. Does it mean we've invented time travel? Is Back to the Future actually a true story? Not yet, as far as I know, but things are moving fast in this world. So one day I may be able to deliver this letter to you in person. Before I get into any advice I might share, I'd like to just say that I love you. You've got such a big heart, little Matthew. It's sensitive, it feels a lot, and it will get broken, but it's beautiful and it's brave. First, laughter is the shortest distance between two people. Right? Life is all about deep connection, and there's no better way to connect than laughter. So no matter what you're dealing with, young Matthew, no matter how hard things seem, look for laughter in every situation. Second, be a best friend to yourself. You are a great friend to others. You see the best in them. You tell them you love them, and you don't hold grudges. But one day you realize you don't always look for the best in yourself. You don't always love yourself, and you won't forgive yourself for things. So try to change that as soon as possible. Third, everyone is scared. Everyone is scared. The bouts of fear that you have will make you think that you don't have the constitution to be an entrepreneur or achieve whatever dreams that you have. Those people that you look up to, they may seem fearless and bold, but they're not. Every adult is just a child pretending to be an adult. And mavericks like Branson or Oprah, they don't make bold choices just because they've eliminated fear, but because they've developed a mindset to get to the other side of it. They recognize that fear is just simply stress caused by the imagined consequences of a future state that only exists in a story in our own minds. You don't need to be fearless to do great things. You just have to turn down the volume on the worries enough to focus on the task at hand. Fourth, love and optimism are superpowers. Those glimpses of a higher order you see, those are real. And if you spread love and you spread optimism, you can change the trajectory of things. And fifth, and the final lesson, bet on Man City to win 4 Premier League titles from 2020 to 2024. It's 1992 when you're reading this, and no one will see it coming.
Oh, Is it just everything? It's everything. You've given us so much of your soul today, and I just can't thank you enough. You've shared with us the whole journey, not only the whole entrepreneurial journey, so eloquently and vulnerably with us, but you've also shared with us more than many people, your literal soul from death to day, the whole journey of Matt. And we're going to take so much from that. But the thing that I really will take for every day is that love and optimism and this frequency that you have shared with us that we can believe in, that we might know, but we've not had the confidence to say it, especially as business folk. You've given us that gift, and you're going to cause your own ripple effects. So thank you so, so much for your time with us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ollie. Thanks for touching my heart.
Thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe, and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams, to build a life they love.